My name is Rob Collins. I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I am the acting director of training and education at CRIS 180 in Atlanta, Georgia. I joined the United States Army in 2004 and ended up going to Baghdad, Iraq in 2005. The majority of the time I spent as a machine gunner on a Humvee. Pretty much would do 10 to 11 hour patrols every day, just about, 7 days a week. I think I would get maybe probably 1 or 2 days off a week. I think I would go get like a coffee or something like that. But during the time we were there, I think explosive form projectiles and snipers and IEDs were just heavily in use. It was a pretty tough time to be around Baghdad, but we were there for just over a year. And then we ended up leaving again in 2006 in November, and we ended up coming back.
First thing is, John mentioned when he returned and he had multiple combat tours, he had TBI. He mentioned to me numbness, emotional numbness, lack of emotional connection to his wife and children upon getting back to civilian life. Why would that be for a person? Wow. I know you don't know him, but like for a person who's experienced combat, why would they have emotional numbness?
One thing to kind of consider, and this is something that I talk a lot about in my clinical work and then when we're doing these trauma trainings is, in what environment is this behavior successful or necessary? And oftentimes when you look at a behavior of somebody that has experienced significant trauma, you can kind of trace it back a little bit to an environment where that would be successful. And you really think about emotional numbness, and that would be successful in combat. You really have to kind of numb yourself. I did the same thing. In our long patrols, you would be afraid that you would die or be killed or have someone you cared about killed as well. So you have to have that kind of emotional numbness just to be able to do your job. If you need that skill in order to survive, then you kind of bring that home with you. And it may be subconsciously, it may not be something consciously, but it's something that you needed to survive and you bring it home.
So one incident that John mentioned to me that really helped him heal, he ended up farming, as we talked about before, and he and his wife ended up saving a dying lamb. And he said after that, what he told me was connections started forming. Why would that be? Why would a physical task like that with his wife help him connect with her after that?
I think it's interesting because I think there's probably this idea of like capability and showing his wife, what he can do. And it's not just about like taking life. It could be about saving lives as well. But it's also something that they did together and being able to see and experience a really powerful, life-changing, altering moment together. And I think oftentimes there's bonds that are made in the field. There's been bonding between people in combat. And so I think that there is also this need and desire to bond over trauma as well. So I think it could be an interesting to think a little bit more about that. But I really think that these like stressful moments can also cause bonding as well.
John has TBI, as I mentioned, and he told me he finds farming has helped heal his brain and improve his memory.
Yeah.
And because he said of the repetitive nature of the work. Can you reflect on that?
Yeah. So TBI, for people that are unfamiliar with it, is traumatic brain injuries. And typically what happens is that somebody that is involved with an IED or an explosion or sometimes even being in car accidents or football players also get TBI as well. Just, your brain is kind of sloshing around in your skull and the damage to the fronts and back of it, it kind of rattles back and forth. And so there's kind of bruising and damage to both parts, both the prefrontal cortex and back of our brains. And as a lot of us know, the prefrontal cortex is where a lot of empathy and reasoning and logic is. And so if there's some damage to that, sometimes it can be very challenging to experience emotions of other people. And so it kind of more leads into more survival instincts. When it comes to repetitive tasks, there's this concept of neuroplasticity that occurs. The research is still kind of like trying to figure out how we can help solve and heal these traumatic brain injuries. But from what they've seen is that repetitive tasks affects that neuroplasticity where they kind of just learn and their brain kind of carves out new pathways around this traumatic brain injury. And so the more times we do things, the more times that we become more proficient at it, especially if there's things that have kind of involved with an injury as well.
One of the things John and I talked about was he said a lot of vets want to control their environment when they get home. Can you help us understand why they would want that sense of control?
Oftentimes when I'm talking about other kind of mental health diagnoses like generalized anxiety disorder, I talk about kind of the calculus of variables in our lives. And so you think about the things that we cannot control in our lives and the things that kind of make us worry and make us concerned, and you try to reduce the number of variables in your life, if you're afraid of being harmed or having a family member harmed, you are going to, you know, live your life in a way that is going to ensure that you have as least amount of variables as possible. So in that case, you may want to stay home. You may want to take the same route. You may want to take back roads to work. You may want to, you know, go to the same restaurant, go to the same places, sit in the same areas. Just make sure that your rituals and routines are very, very similar, so you are reducing the amount of possible variables in your life that can also add more stress and more challenge to you.
You had talked to me about you don't really care for the label post-traumatic stress disorder. So do you want to talk to me about that?
There is this interesting thing when you look at the history of kind of trauma and how we've decided to study it and what we've decided to call it. And it has gone by so many different names. You know, you think about back in the day in like World War I, it was called like shell shock. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of other phrases throughout the Civil War, throughout World War I, World War II, you know, and just the perspective of how we saw trauma and how we saw it has changed dramatically over the years. And so I've kind of had a hard time calling it post-traumatic stress disorder, even though obviously, you know, you have to make these diagnoses for insurance and for medication, et cetera. But when you're working with a client, it doesn't hit as home for them. I think that they kind of see their experience. They've almost, a lot of people, especially veterans, have lived in trauma. They've lived in it multiple days for years at a time, multiple years, you know. What I've typically called it is this idea of a hazardous environmental adaptation syndrome, you know, where somebody has experienced a hazardous environment, just through their human spirit, they have adapted as a result. Those adaptations have helped them survive. And in these hazardous environments, it helps them survive. But the problem is those hazardous environments, when they come back, that's where things become really challenging. And that's where trauma and kind of post-traumatic stress disorder kind of takes over.
Have you experienced that yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, after I came back from Iraq in 2006, I was like filling up my gas tank. And somebody had driven over a Coke bottle. You know, you tighten it really tight and it makes this loud explosion when somebody drives over it. And the cap whizzed by my ear and struck the metal gas tank behind me. And I was probably months from coming back. And I got on my stomach and crawled under my car and I was looking for my rifle. So I had, you know, oil and gas all over my white dress shirt. And I had somebody stand over me and they're like, "Hey, are you okay?" And I was not okay. You know, I'm in Dunwoody, Georgia, under a Jeep, you know, looking for a rifle. This is not, you know, my shining moment in my life. So that was when I was like, yep, I definitely need help. I definitely need to talk to somebody. I definitely need to seek professional help for this. Trauma is a universal experience, and we all have experienced it. It depends on the degree and the severity and the duration of that trauma, but we've all seen it. We've all experienced it. And these women and men that have experienced significant combat, overseas, it's kind of similar trauma to a lot of us. And you treat it the same way. You interact with it the same way. But I think the most important thing that you can do for folks that have experienced this stuff is validate that and kind of find an environment and ask yourself, you know, in what environment is this behavior successful or necessary? Mm-hmm. If they are confused and frustrated, you know, just like me under my Jeep when I'm looking for my rifle, you ask yourself, in what environment is this behavior successful or necessary? You're going to be able to make that connection to a scenario where you are in danger and you need to hide and you need to find your rifle. If you take a moment and you say you're confused by literally any behavior that most humans have, and you say, "Wow, you know, in what environment is this behavior successful or necessary?" It doesn't even have to be related to combat. You know, somebody that hasn't been to combat and you're confused as to why somebody would behave this way, you would say, and you can really trace that back. And if you see that and you're curious about that, you can validate that with them. And that has such significant power in helping them co-regulate and kind of bring their emotions down to
them. What does that look like to validate?
So if somebody maybe they had a nightmare or maybe they are emotionally elevated, you can say, "Yeah, you know, I see you're really elevated right now. And of course you're going to. You've been through a lot." And just having another human see you as something that you've been through. And yeah, you've been through a lot. And it's okay. It's okay to be a little bit elevated. You know, what do you need from me? What can we do? You know, do you, if we're at a restaurant and, you know, somebody drops makes a loud noise. I've had experiences like that. I was in, IKEA one time, and you know how they have those huge, gigantic boxes that are incredibly tall, and I think one of the lines that was right next to me, somebody dropped the box, and it landed flat on, kind of horizontally on the floor, and it made an incredibly loud bang next to me, and I kind of froze, and I had someone just say, you know, what, I can see your elevator right now. What do you need from me? And so I was kind of able to say, look, I'm okay. And this was probably maybe 2 years ago for me. There's still some residual stuff going on. Spotting it, being able to recognize it, being able to validate it, and then being able to help them see that they are elevated as well. And it is as a result of that. All of us have memories and experiences that are traumatizing to us. And so I think rather than viewing it as, you know, a debilitation, I think that you just think about it as a memory. And if you can integrate your traumatic experience into your life, you are not only going to be stronger and more powerful and more resilient, but you're going to be more capable of helping others really navigate stress and trauma in their life.